This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
MSW Media.
Rule of law is not just some lawyer's turn of phrase. It is the very foundation of our democracy. The essence of the rule of law is that like cases are treated alike. That there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans, one rule for the powerful, another for the powerless, one rule for the rich and another for the poor, or different rules depending upon one's race or ethnicity. To serve as Attorney General at this critical time is a calling I am honored and eager to answer.
So yeah, now it's clean up on aisle 45 time. And for a long while yet, it is going to be clean up on aisle 45.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 140 of Clean Up on Aisle 45. It's Wednesday, September 27th. I'm your host, Allison Gill.
And I'm Pete Strzok. We have a great show for you with lots to cover, including Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss filing a notice that Rudy Giuliani has failed to respond to a court order, along with Rudy's lawyer suing him for $1.4 million. We also now have multiple witnesses disputing the Jim Jordan IRS whistleblowers in the Hunter Biden debacle and the New York Attorney General's opposition to a Trump Organization fraud trial delay.
Yes, and we also have news about the House Republicans receiving a brief on a series of Biden documents from the National Archives that turned up, you guessed it, nothing. And I'm really excited, Pete, because we're going to be joined by legal fellow and courts correspondent for Lawfare, a Georgian who has been doggedly reporting on all things Fulton County and other stuff as well, Anna Bauer.
Yeah, she's amazing.
She's truly, truly incredible. We're going to be talking about the Cheesebro motions to dismiss count 9 of his, along with his motion to suppress search warrant evidence and his push to interview grand jurors. We'll also discuss the Clark, Jeffrey Clark, and the fraudulent elector removal hearings they want to remove to federal court from Georgia State Court. And we're going to talk about the sort of flipping of Lynn Wood and then some conflicts of interest filings. But first, we want to thank some new patrons. You make the show go. So thank you so much to Christine Berner, Jay Brown, Vanessa M., Kathy Freeman, John J. Keepers, LMNOP, Jesse Shira, and Gene Jarvis. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And if you want to become a patron, you'll get these episodes early and you'll get them ad-free, as well as access to the bonus weekend episodes. You get twice as many episodes. So you can sign up at patreon.com/aisle45pod. That's AISLE 45POD.
And with that, let's welcome Quartz correspondent for Lawfare, Anna Bauer. Huge fan, Anna, of your work, and certainly have been a fan of Lawfare for a long, long time. And they're fortunate to have you covering not only Fulton County, but all across the various sort of legal trials that are going on in and around Trumpland. So thank you so much for joining us. I guess I first want to start out by going down to Fulton County and some of the early things going on with Kenneth Chesbrough. Can you sort of walk us through? He's got a number of motions in. Can you kind of walk us through the things that are pending from his camp down there at Fulton County?
Of course. And thanks so much for having me. I'm a big fan of the show, so I'm really happy to be on and joining you guys today. So Ken Chesbrough, what is going on with the cheese? Because there's a lot. He has a trial that is scheduled for October 23rd along with Sidney Powell. So the motions are coming fast and furious in Fulton County with Ken Chesbrough and Sidney Powell as well. But it's mostly been Chesbrough who's been filing things. So just to run you through an idea of what some of the pending motions are, and we haven't had any rulings on these from Judge McAfee, who's the presiding judge in the case. One is a motion to quash the indictment. Of course, Ken Chesbrough here, it's important to remind folks that he's not only charged with the overarching racketeering charge for joining an enterprise to overturn the 2020 election in Donald Trump's favor, but he's also charged with conspiracy to file false documents. That's related to his alleged role as the architect of the fake electors plot to submit an electoral slate to the archives and to the governor of Georgia and to other government bodies, claiming that, you know, the Trump electors were the duly elected and qualified electors from the state of Georgia, when in fact they were not. So in order to, you know, get rid of those conspiracy to file false documents charges, Chesbrough is arguing that the electors, when they filed that document that said they were duly elected and qualified, they weren't, you know, false. They were actually saying that they weren't the electors from Georgia, but they were the Republican electors from Georgia. So he's trying to say that that wasn't a false statement because, you know, these folks really were these, Republicans who are elected by the state party under state law. You know, that's kind of how it works, is that a few months before the election, the candidates who are running for president, they will each have members from their party who are kind of appointed or nominated to be electors in the event that that person wins the popular vote in the state. And then, of course, you know, the Electoral Count Act specifies that on December 14th or whatever day is specified by Congress under the Constitution, those folks get together and then they send the electoral votes to the governor, who pairs it with a certificate of ascertainment. And then, you know, that is on January 6th when the joint session of Congress meets. Those are the certificates that are counted from the state of Georgia. So here they're saying what really matters is that they were appointed by the state party. And so that's why it's not a fake certificate. That, I think, is not going to be something that will be successful, in part because the certificate itself says nothing about qualifying the statement, right? It literally says, we, the undersigned, being the duly elected and qualified electors for president and vice president from the state of Georgia. They don't say anything about being the Republican electors from the state of Georgia. But it's not only that. It's also the case that, you know, they make this argument that they point to these extra legal statements that were made by David Schaefer at this December 14th, 2020 meeting, in which he says, you know, we're here in a contingent capacity in case that litigation changes the outcome of the election. We're here just to preserve the rights of the Republican nominee electors. So they point to that. But the problem for Ken Chesbrough is that he wrote a series of memos prior to December 14th, in which he makes it very clear that the intention of submitting these electoral documents was not just in a contingent capacity. It was, in fact, to, you know, potentially convince Pence to count the votes from the Republican electors in Georgia, even if there was no change because of litigation in Georgia. So I think that's really important. And I think that this motion is one that I am not convinced will be successful. But if you guys want to chime in before I move it on to some of the other motions, please do.
Well, especially up against the fact that there were other states that put that contingency language in their certification, like Pennsylvania was like, hey, this is only if for some reason in the courts this is litigated and it's turned over and you need these slates by the drop dead date of December 14th. That's why we're signing this and sending this forward, not to say that we are the duly elected, you know, or, you know, appointed electors for the thing. So, you know, I don't think this is going to be successful either, because not only do we have the arguments that you've put forth, but you have other examples of states who did this other thing and put that contingency language in there, and you put them next to each other. And it's there, to me, that's like no contest. So that's sort of probably not even an argument that has to come up. But, you know, certainly one that if I were a lawyer, I'm weird. I would raise it. But, you know, that's just me. So, I don't think this is going to be successful. I don't think many of his motions are going to be successful. Of course, that doesn't preclude him from trying to file them anyway.
Right. And I think and so related to this motion that is about the fake electors, he also has this second motion that kind of makes a somewhat similar argument, but he's trying to say that the indictment should be quashed because basically he's saying that the Electoral Count Act preempts in any sort of state criminal prosecution that is based on the fake elector plot. He has this really complicated argument that I don't want to get too much in the weeds on here because I want to keep it understandable for folks. But it's basically he's trying to say, like, you know, Georgia, he argues that Georgia didn't meet what's called the safe harbor deadline, which is this deadline that's set out in the Electoral Count Act. And it's usually the kind of date before the electors meet in December, by which time the state is supposed to have certified its election results and have all pending litigation kind of resolved. And so Chesbrough is making this argument that because Georgia didn't meet its safe harbor or allegedly did not meet its safe harbor deadline in December of 2020, that meant that, you know, all power reverted back to Congress. Georgia no longer had any power to have any say over, you know, who the electors would be. And it all, you know, just went to the two houses of Congress to decide. And that's why, you know, whatever happened after that safe harbor deadline, which was, I believe, December 8th of 2020 at the time, anything that happened after that with the fake electors meeting and all of that, that was all, you know, under federal law. And it's something that the state can't now, you know, criminalize. It's something that I think they're probably filing this motion now because they want to be able to raise this argument later on before the jury. They want to go into this, you know, motion to dismiss hearing and have the state say, you know, this is a factual question for the jury, and that's for the jury to decide. And then, you know, hopefully they'll have a better chance of having the judge later on then allow them to raise it because the state has said this is for a jury to decide. But on the law itself, I really just don't think it's going to succeed because that's not really how preemption works. Like they make this argument that because the Electoral Count Act has this statement about receiving certificates that purport to be electoral certificates, that envisions or anticipates that there could be, you know, multiple certificate electoral slates that are received by Congress. But just because the Electoral Count Act says that, it doesn't mean, in my view, that a state could not criminalize what it means to purport to send a certificate saying that you are the state's valid electors when you are in fact not, right? Mm-hmm. So it doesn't seem to me that there's actually a conflict between the federal law and the state law here, and the criminalization of what these electors did. So I just really don't see how this argument that federal law should, you know, preempt or kind of supersede any state law will succeed. It just doesn't seem likely to me. But curious to hear your thoughts.
No, I mean, look, I think that is absolutely, I have some question about whether or not they're doing this because of the legal merits or two, just because it is an opportunity to throw crap against the wall and slow things down. I'm curious, is a lot of this coming out of Chesbro and not Powell only because he's better funded and or has better representation and Powell is kind of out there, you know, kind of on her own craziness, or is that some sort of agreement that he is going to take the lead, or just that he has potentially different arguments and a better even however unlikely that he still has a better chance of making these arguments than she does? Do you think there's any sort of discussion or dialogue? It seems to me he doesn't want to be with her, but is stuck with her for the purpose of a speedy trial.
I've kind of seen that with Trump too, where he's like, people file motions and he's like, yeah, ditto, me too. You know, I don't know if we'll see that with Powell, but you know, who knows what their agreement is.
Right. So I think with Powell, part of it with these, because a lot of the Chesbro motions that relate to the fake electors plot, you know, those aren't going to apply to Powell as much because her case, even though they're both charged with the RICO conspiracy, her case is much more related to the Coffee County breach, which Chesbro is not accused of separately beyond the RICO charge. So I think that she has had some motions coming in, you know, claiming that the breach in Coffee County was authorized, which I've, you know, done reporting on what happened in Coffee County, and all of my reporting indicates that it very much was not authorized, but they seem to be arguing that it was. She has, you know, a few motions that are coming in, but it just seems like Chesbro potentially does have a larger legal team. You know, Sidney Powell's only has one attorney who's working on the case, as far as I'm aware. I'm sure that he has associates who, you know, are working with him. But in terms of folks who are making appearances in court, it's only been Brian Rafferty for Sidney Powell, whereas Chesbro has at least three attorneys who show up to every hearing. And so it may be the funding aspect of it all. I'm not entirely sure. And it may be, like I said, that we see some more motions coming in from Powell, you know, this week or in the next few weeks when some of these deadlines start to hit for getting pretrial motions in. But moving on to...
I want to take a quick diversion as long as we're talking about Sidney Powell and voting stuff. Do you think she, like clearly the Coffee County stuff, but she was also involved in, you know, like up in Antrim County up in Michigan, Maricopa County, and not just her, but people like Catherine Freeze and Doug Logan. Do you think, I mean, one, do you think Fulton County's done? Like they have indicted everybody they're going to indict. And then the second part of the question is, do you think there are folks like, you know, Michigan has indicted a bunch of local Michigan Republican Party type folks, but do you see other states bringing indictments specifically against sort of these national figures, particularly Sidney Powell, but also those other, I mean, there are a group of, and like Patrick Byrne flying all these folks
around. Or the
around.
Feds, for that matter.
Or the feds, for that matter. Do you think, or have you heard anything in your reporting that there might be future state charges either in Georgia or outside of Georgia coming down for the sort of voting infrastructure tampering type stuff?
Right. There could be in Georgia, but maybe not from Fani Willis's office. The GBI has been investigating the breach in Coffee County of voting systems there for, I want to say, if not over a year, then it's coming up on a year now. It has seemed to be the case that, I mean, and again, you know, as we all know, what is happening publicly in investigation does not always reflect what is happening internally, because there's just so much that the media doesn't know and that members of the public doesn't know, because it's very closed off from view. But with that said, it did seem for some time that the GBI was kind of slow walking that investigation. There wasn't a lot happening. I was very regularly submitting open records requests down in Coffee County, and there wasn't a whole lot coming back. But right before the Fulton County indictments came down, there what seemed to be a little bit more activity going on down there. My understanding from the open records request is that the GBI received some search warrants. They are sealed, so I don't know what they are for, but they seemed to be related to the Coffee County computer breach in 2021. And they also appeared to have seized a computer that was used by the election supervisor who is now indicted in Fulton County, Misty Hampton. So that was, you know, some new movement. And there are people who were not indicted in Fulton County who were involved in that breach or allegedly involved in that breach that could potentially be indicted, maybe not in Fulton County, but, you know, by the GBI as a result of that investigation. So we will see. In terms of, you know, other jurisdictions, I really don't know, but you make a great point that it seems like there's so much more to this story of a widespread and potentially coordinated plot to access voting machines in various states throughout the country. And I think that it has not received maybe as much attention as it should. I'm very curious to see if Jack Smith ultimately turns his focus to that. It seems like maybe they've been kind of, you know, asking some questions about it. There's been some recent reporting that they have been asking about the plans to access voting machines, but it's to be, you know, seen whether or not that's something that they expand the investigation even further to focus on, because it may be that they think, you know, that would be going too far in terms of scope with the special counsel's investigation.
Yeah. And one last quick follow-up on like GBI's jurisdiction. Would they typically, I mean, they operate throughout Georgia. Do they have the authority, or where would they bring cases? In other words, can they go into county jurisdictions and bring cases there? Is that typically how it would work, that if they did find malfeasance or additional criminal wrongdoing, that they would bring that in Coffee County? Or what is their sort of entry into the state judicial system?
You know, it's a really good question, and I'm not entirely familiar with how the GBI tends to operate, but they got involved here. I believe it was because of the Secretary of State's office asked them to get involved after the breach became public. And so it's not clear to me whether it's the kind of thing where, you know, they investigate and then it's the attorney general who seeks an indictment, or whether it would be they then hand over, you know, everything to the Coffee County local district attorney. And then it's in that capacity that someone would be indicted. So great question. And I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to it, but
no, that's OK. We do have to take a really quick break here, and then we're going to come back. We're going to talk about the other Chesbro motions. We're going to talk about the removal hearings. And then, of course, I want to ask you about Lynn Wood and maybe some, if we have time, to talk about conflicts of interest. But we need to take a quick break here. Everybody stick around. We'll be right back.
This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money. That'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me in a courtroom how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing in the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
All right, welcome back. We have some more patrons to thank. Thank you to Mark Sterling, Jay Kasler, Anita Sovine, Ricky Martinez, Amanda Davis, Ralph Glidden, and Kathleen Horniak. Thank you all so much. You make this program go, and we simply couldn't do it without you. And so now let's back with Anna Bauer, a correspondent for Lawfare and a expert on everything going on down in Georgia and generally around Trump world. And I want to finish up. We were talking some about Chesbrough's various motions, and we took a little diversion into GBI and other states. But so let's go back to Ken, to the cheese. Where what other motions is he pending?
Is it cheese or Ches? Because I call him Cheesebro.
So I asked his attorneys about this. It is Ken Chesbrough, but his nickname, because he's from Wisconsin, and his longtime nickname from, you know, childhood and college was the cheese. So okay. Chesbrough in terms of pronouncing his name, but nickname the cheese.
I'm a little disappointed, but I'll go with the nickname. Anyway, the diversion. Let's go back to his motions. Thank you so much for answering that, because I know a lot of people were curious.
Right. So the motions. Great. So there's a few other motions. One is this motion to suppress search warrant evidence. We learned from this motion that in July, Fulton County judge signed off on a search warrant to Chesbrough's Microsoft email account. And that warrant was subsequently executed, and presumably documentary evidence was received from that search warrant. His legal team now wants to suppress that evidence. They make the argument that the evidence should be suppressed because there is a Georgia statute that places some, you know, protective limits on searches and seizures of evidence in the possession of attorneys. And, you know, the reason for that is that you want to be really careful about protecting attorney-client privilege information. So this statute sets out some limits around, you know, what has to happen when you search an attorney's documents, right? So they say that the statute wasn't followed, and that therefore Chesbrough's the evidence obtained from Chesbrough Bro should be suppressed. But the problem for Chaz Bro here is that the statute specifically only applies to attorneys who are not criminal suspects.
Oops.
Yeah. So, and it literally says that in the statute, and they try to, you know, in a footnote, they point this out and they try to say that, well, actually, you know, the district attorney can't say that Chaz Bro was a suspect then because he never received a target letter. And, you know, there was never any indication that he was a suspect. But in Georgia, they actually don't use target letters the way that you would in the federal system. So I just don't think that that is going to fly in terms of an argument. And it's clear that, you know, Chaz Bro has been a potential suspect for some time. It seems like it just is not going, it's going to be a non-starter in terms of making this argument that, you know, at the time the search warrant was issued, he wasn't a suspect. And then beyond that motion, oh, right, we have another motion in which he challenges the RICO charge on grounds that he says that the indictment does not allege a pecuniary gain motive on the part of the enterprise. So just to explain that a little bit, in Georgia, you know, there we have this racketeering statute. And when it was passed, the legislature also passed this statement of legislative intent, and it kind of sets out, you know, how the legislature intended the RICO statute to apply. And one of the lines in that statement, which I should specify, like a statement of legislative intent is not, you know, the statutory the code law, itself. Right. It's not the law. It's just, you know, a statement that says like, this is what we wanted whenever we passed this law and this is why we passed it. Or that
sounds like something
thing.
You can raise on appeal, like down the road to have somebody right. interpret this statute. Right. But yeah. Okay.
Right. Yes, exactly. It's kind of like if maybe a judge would look at it when they're interpreting the statute itself. Right. So in that statement, the legislature wrote that, you know, something about the law was passed to kind of criminalize these enterprises that are motivated by, you know, pecuniary gain. And then later on, it was amended to say that it also, you know, was intended to target criminal enterprises that are motivated by, you know, physical threat or, you know, that kind of thing. So it has to be like pecuniary gain or physical threat or physical injury that is kind of motivating or is the outcome or end result of the criminal enterprise. And Chaz Bro's team is saying nothing in the indictment here that's about the Trump campaign and about efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Nothing here goes to the question of any kind of, you know, pecuniary gain resulting from this conduct or being, you know, motivating the conduct.
Narrator, yes, it does.
Right? Yeah. And, you know, you're right. Yes, it does, because we know from, you know, the January 6th committee, we know from various other reports that the Trump campaign was using these claims of fraud to raise money. The Save America PAC has been a huge source of pecuniary gain for Donald Trump to fund his legal defenses. So, and you know, there's a question here about whether or not the indictment says those things. So there might be some kind of argument that maybe if it's the case that Georgia law does require some kind of pecuniary gain or result or motivate the enterprise, maybe at one end of the spectrum, it could be that Fannie Willis has to do a superseding indictment, right? In which it's actually specifies that there were these financial incentives and results that came from these claims of election fraud and attempts to overturn the election. But I just don't think that the court is going to go for this idea that a RICO prosecution has to include some kind of, you know, pecuniary gain or motive, because it's not the law. It's just a statement of legislative intent.
Well, does it have to be straight up money, or can it be something of value? Because retaining the presidency and your chief of staff job would certainly have value attached to it, I would think, if you had to. I mean, I guess she could just cure this by doing, like you said, the superseding indictment to include the fundraising off the big lie. But I mean, you know, it's not just about cash or, you know, gold bars in your jacket pockets or whatever.
Hey, who among us?
No, I think that's absolutely right. And there is, and I need to look into this a little bit more, but, you know, I'm aware of at least one RICO prosecution that involved a person, you know, trying to stay in office. And I don't know the particular details of that prosecution. And I don't think that this particular question was raised in that case, but I point to it to say that, you know, there are examples of, you know, RICO enterprises that were motivated towards keeping someone in office that have been prosecuted in Georgia law in the past. And there, it seems to be that there was no question in those cases, or in that case, that, you know, that was something that the law was intended to apply to. So, you know, we'll see what happens, but I just don't think Judge McAfee is going to be very impressed by this argument.
Yeah. And Allison, I know you want to talk about Linwood. Do you, Anna, before we go to that, do you think this happens October 23rd, or do you think it's going to get pushed back?
I do think that it happens. So I think it probably will happen October 23rd, which is a little bit surprising to me because I never thought we would be here saying that a trial would actually happen in a month. I thought it would be at least a year. It will be somewhat astonishing if it does happen. But at this point in time, my understanding is that the defense team for Chesbro is very motivated to actually make it happen. I do understand, though, as well, based on, you know, comments that they've made at a hearing, that based on what happens with some of these motions that we've just discussed, it could be the case that they seek an interlocutory appeal on some of those motions. So that basically means that, you know, they're trying to go to the appeals court and get this issue litigated and resolved before the trial is even happening, right? And that in Georgia is a discretionary appeal. So Judge McAfee doesn't have to allow it. But if he does, then that means that the speedy trial demand is tolled. So while that appeal is ongoing, you know, the clock kind of stops. And then it may be that it's several weeks or potentially even several months before those appeals are exhausted, which could, you know, delay things significantly. And that would be both, but even if only Chesbro or only Powell files for an interlocutory appeal because they are together in the case, then it means that the clock would be paused for both of them. So both of the trials would be on hold.
And those appeals go to the Georgia Supreme Court?
To the Georgia Court of Appeals first, and then to the Georgia Supreme Court, depending on the outcome and what happens. But like I said, it's discretionary. So Judge McAfee doesn't have to let them, you know, appeal. He could, you know, say, nope, sorry. And then it's something that they, you know, would raise later on, I'm sure. But so we'll see. But I think it's happening. And I think Judge McAfee is really motivated to get jury selection done by November 5th. That will be shocking as well if it actually happens, but it seems like he's I've been extremely impressed by Judge McAfee. He seems like a really competent jurist and he's been moving things along. So I think it's happening.
Wow. Yeah. And, you know, that's interesting that he has the discretion on those interlocutory appeals and that also, you know, it could toll things because I was wondering how it worked down in Georgia, because I know how it works federally. But I was like, are tolls allowed in the speedy trial? Because I know it says it has to be done by not this, but the next court, you know, session and all the, you know, all these other things. But no, it's interesting that they can toll it if the judge allows those appeals to go forward. We'll have to see. But yeah, he does seem motivated. I was watching the hearing. We all were on television when he was like, November 5th, keep your panel of jury questions to a limited time, like almost like at a comedy show. I'm going to give you the light, you know, at a certain amount of time so we can get through all of this and get a jury seated. So it'll be interesting to see how fast that goes. All right, let's talk about Lynn Wood, because everybody was like, oh my God, Lynn Wood flipped. And then, you know, I was like, I don't know if that's really true. What can you tell us about what's going on? Because I think it was sort of buried in a filing that he was going to be a witness for the government in this case. What do you take away from that?
Yeah, so you're right. It came out in a filing. Fannie Willis's team filed this motion saying that, you know, it's possible that some of these defense attorneys have potential conflicts because they've previously represented people who will be witnesses for the state in the upcoming trial. And it was in that motion that they said, you know, so-and-so attorney represented Lynn Wood and or was co-counsel to Lynn Wood. And he is a witness for the state in the trial that's coming up in October. We all know that Lynn Wood would be a terrible witness.
Yes.
I mean, this is a man who, talk about impeaching a witness. This is a guy who would truly be, it seems like he would be incredibly easy to impeach in terms of, there's so many problems or potential problems with putting him on a stand and expecting a jury to expecting him to be a star witness. So I just don't think that Lynn Wood is going to be the key witness in the state's case. And he himself on Telegram has been saying for days now that he has not flipped on Trump. He's still talking about how much he loves Trump and how great Trump is. And he does say, though, that he was subpoenaed to appear at Powell. He says it's Powell's trial, of course, because Powell's being tried with Ken Chesbro. It's both of their trials, technically. But he says that he was subpoenaed to appear in the Powell trial. He says he does not know what he has been subpoenaed for or why. It could be a few things. Like I said, I don't think he's going to be the state's main witness. But what I do know is that during the special grand jury investigation, that's the grand jury that kind of investigated the 2020 election case for 7 months, Wood did testify before the special grand jury. He also, you know, is a figure who has knowledge about some of those early discussions around the 2020 election and what the Trump campaign team was planning. He hosted people like Sidney Powell, people like Patrick Byrne, various figures within the Trump campaign at his plantation in November of 2020 after the election. And we also know from the January 6th committee transcripts that it was there that they first started discussing, you know, how to access voting machines. And of course, Sidney Powell is charged with computer trespass and a variety of other computer related crimes for her involvement in the Coffee County voting machine access plot. So it could be that there's some kind of limited, knowledge or testimony that Lynn Wood is willing to appear and testify truthfully to. But like I said, I'm a little bit skeptical that the state is going to rely on him as kind of a crucial witness. And so one of the other reasons why he might be called to testify is simply to serve as, an authentication witness. So
that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. So in the rules of evidence, as you guys are aware, often if you have documents or papers or video or something like that, you have to authenticate it to get into evidence. That means you have to prove that it's, genuine or, that it is actually what the state says it is. And so Lynn Wood could be someone who, the state just puts on the stand in order to authenticate or say that a document really is what they say it is so that they can get it into evidence. It seems much more likely that if he is put on the stand, it is for that really limited purpose. And with that said, also important to say that, you know, witness lists are not always, you know, definite. The state often puts people on their witness list and then they don't call them. So it could be a situation where, you know, he's on there and then he's not called. So we'll see.
Yeah. And so I remember, too, that I think Joe Flynn, who's Mike Flynn's brother, took to Twitter and called Lynn after this news came out, took to Twitter and called him a rat. He deleted the tweet. Then he reposted the tweet. And I remember there was a lot of drama at some point that, you know, people recording other people within this group of that plantation crowd of Patrick Byrne, Sidney Powell, and Lynn Wood. Is there an antagonism or a split that between Flynn and Lynn Wood that generated that sort of, you know, outburst from Joe Flynn?
It seems like there is. I'm not sure what the precise circumstances are behind that split. There's a lot of beef between a lot of those folks. Like, there's the Lynn Wood and Michael Flynn apparent beef. And then there's also, you know, Lynn and Sidney, they have had a falling out. And Lynn, you know, when he's been questioned after the 2020 election about his involvement in some of the suits, he always says, oh, it was just Sidney who roped me into that. And I didn't have anything to do with it. And she just put my name on it and all this kind of stuff. And then, of course, Giuliani and Powell, you know, just totally disdain each other. So it's just a mess. And it will be interesting to see how some of those interpersonal dynamics potentially play out in the trial.
Yeah. Yes. Bag of rats, we like to say. So any final thoughts, anything else you want to add? We've got about a minute left. I just wanted to know if there was anything else you wanted to make sure that we knew going into this week.
Something that I think is going to be really interesting this week is, you know, we've had all these severance motions that happen. And of course, the big group of 17 were split from Powell and Chesbro. And when Judge McAfee ordered that split, he said, you know, basically anyone who doesn't want to be included with Chesbro and Powell on October 23rd, you need to file a waiver of your speedy trial demand. And so that means basically, you know, that a defendant will say, like, I'm not going to try to get a speedy trial demand under the statute that allows for it under Georgia law. But interestingly, what he said is that, you know, anyone who hasn't done so or filed that waiver by, you know, X date is automatically going to join the Powell and Chesbro trial. And
you have to opt out.
Yeah, you have to opt out. And we have seen that there are three people. I think it's three. I need to check this, but I think it's Mike Roman, John Eastman, and Misty Hampton who have not filed waivers yet. And I think that McAfee said in that order he would revisit the question of any other severance issues or kind of these issues with the speedy trial demand by September 29th. So I have my eye on whether or not it might not just be state of Georgia versus Ken Chesbro and Sidney Powell. It could end up being, you know, a few other people who are thrown in there if they don't file their speedy trial waivers. So we'll see.
Great. Well, I know Pete has to run. Pete has a hit, I think, coming up on MSNBC. But I did want to also mention before we go to a break that there were hearings for removal to federal court, both for Jeffrey Clark and for three of the fraudulent electors. They didn't go well. I don't think they're going to be successful, but we're waiting for those to drop too. Anna Bauer, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
For coming on.
Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Everybody find Anna Bauer on social media. Check out her work at Lawfare. She covers all manner of justice news. It's well worth the follow. Thank you again so much for helping explain everything going on in Fulton County.
Yep. And love to have you back as trials start. And if God forbid we actually are knee deep in trial in a month's time, I'd love to have you back on either now, then, or whenever to talk about it as it unfolds. You're going to be covering everything down in Fulton County?
I will be there. I hope they say it's going to be 4 months. We'll see. but I'll be there.
Nice. Nice. Well, thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you. Bye. Cheers. And yep, everybody, thanks. We'll be right back. And we have more after this quick break. Everybody stick around.
This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me in a courtroom how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. We have a few more patrons to thank. New signups, including Don O'Brien, Praveen Segal, Anne Sullivan Frome, Ed Ingber, Michael Murphy, Comb Over Hair Stormy, and Carol Bilergian. I hope I'm pronouncing that properly. I'm sorry if I butchered your name. But thank you. Thank you so much. We really appreciate all you do to make this show happen. All right, let's jump to Rudy, because to put it bluntly, he's fucked. Man, Pete, I haven't used that clip since the Mueller days, but it's really appropriate here. By the way, that is from the Voices of the People Choir, which is a choir made up of houseless, the unhoused in San Diego, and they raise money. They made it to America's Got Talent after we featured them on our Mueller, She Wrote podcast, but it was time to bring that back. So this is from the filing from Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss last week. Plaintiffs Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss, by and through their counsel, hereby notify the court of defendant Rudolph Giuliani's failure to comply with the court's order of August 30th, 2023, granting plaintiff's motion for discovery sanctions, here going forward known as the sanctions order, and for the court's information, state the following. First of all, number one, the sanctions order ordered the defendant Giuliani to take or cause the Giuliani businesses to take certain actions by September 20th, including producing complete responses to the plaintiff's request for production, Numbers 40 and 41. So those two specific things. Also, to ensure that Giuliani Communications LLC and Giuliani Partners LLC, those are the two businesses that combined own two turntables and a microphone only, collectively known as the Giuliani businesses, produce complete responses to the plaintiff's request for financial documents and viewership metrics, viewership metrics, including RFP numbers 19 and 35, that's request for production numbers 19 and 35, and designate one or more corporate representatives to sit for depositions on behalf of the Giuliani businesses. Basically, you need to sit down and answer questions about whether or not you really only have a couple of microphones. Also, they were supposed to reimburse plaintiffs' attorneys' fees and costs associated with their successful first motion to complete discovery in the amount totaling $89,172.50, and to ensure by September 20th that Giuliani businesses reimburse the plaintiffs' attorneys' fees associated with their successful motion to compel discovery from the businesses in the amount totaling about $42,600, but plus interest on that amount to accrue from September 30th against defendant Rudy Giuliani personally if his businesses fail to timely comply. And finally, as of this date, defendant Giuliani has failed to take any of the actions or to cause the Giuliani businesses to take any of the actions so ordered in that sanctions order. What do you think about this, Pete?
Yeah, I mean, look, Rudy is, I think you're right, he's fucked. I don't know that there's any way that he's got enough money, and we'll talk a little bit about more demands on his money that have come down the pike since we last talked about it. But keep in mind, this is not any of the damages that are going to come about as a result of the defamation that there was that, you know, the guilty verdict from the bench that was found when that trial comes in December. These are pre-existing penalties for his essentially failing to play by the rules of the game as a, you know, as a defendant, as a longtime attorney, as a former federal prosecutor and U.S. attorney, his utter disregard for the criminal justice system and his obligations to produce discovery, which were so bad that the judge said, look, I'm awarding you all of these attorney fees, you know, some total of whatever that is, $130,000+, just for your bad behavior in the conduct of the civil trial. So this doesn't even address anything that he may and likely will, in my opinion, get ordered to pay as a result of defaming Seamus and Ruby Freeman. This is just his bad behavior along the way. So I don't, for Judge
like
Howell.
It's like Armageddon. We aren't even in outer space yet. We're just in the beginning part of space.
Right. And it's already bad. And oh, by the way, you continued having already like screwed around with the judge, having already incurred her ire. You were doing nothing but, you know, this pot, which is simmering, if not boiling, you're just doubling down and turning up the temperature on it. So at some point, we joked about it a little bit, but I can honestly see if Rudy keeps down this path, he may be the first person imprisoned out of all this crew just by his sheer refusal to abide by the court's orders. Because again, part of what the court can do, and, you know, they've already levied financial, penalties, but there's some indication that Rudy's saying at least that he doesn't have any money. You can start doubling fines for Elon Musk or for Donald Trump, but when it comes to Rudy, he doesn't have a lot of money. At some point, those penalties might turn from financial ones into physical liberty ones, and that wouldn't be unusual. I mean, that's not unheard of people who are recurringly contemptuous of their obligations to a court and the orders of the court to find their ass hauled in and put in jail. So, do I think that is imminent? No. Do I think Rudy is, you know, more than kind of a, you know, it's a serious discussion that we can have about is he potentially facing jail time as a result of contempt? Yeah, I think we're at the point of being able to talk about that without it being some sort of pie in the sky thing.
Yeah, in fact, it's so not unheard of that we might have gotten a preview of what could happen to Rudy down in Florida recently. Pete, we had Roger Stone associate and Proud Boys adjacent guy Jacob Engels, who just had a bodily whatever put out on him, a warrant for his arrest.
I was going to say that's what happens after he gets into the prison yard. No, you're talking about something else. Never.
Yeah, the cavity search, right? No, but for contempt in a defamation case, he refused to produce discovery because somebody, you know, who was running for office down there is suing him for defamation. And he refused to produce discovery. And now there's a warrant out for his arrest for contempt. So he is on the lam. He is a wanted fugitive now for contempt of court. And I immediately thought of Rudy, because this is a discovery defamation case order that he has failed time and again to respond to. And now you can add the fact that he was supposed to pay sanctions and have somebody sit down from the Rudy businesses and talk about what they're worth and be deposed in that way. And he was supposed to do that 5 days ago, and they have nothing. So this is a it's a notice, basically. It's like a, hey, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, judge. Rudy hasn't done anything.
Yeah.
Neither have his businesses. So I could see this not going well for him because, as you said, the judge is already like done.
Right. And the judgment's already been entered. And all of this is based on Rudy's not stupid. His attorney isn't stupid. This is all based on a calculation that whatever it is they're not producing, his financials, other discovery, whatever in there is so bad that they judge a better outcome is simply to ignore the discovery obligations and ignore providing some expert to talk about his financial status, that information that has not been turned over as required by law, as ordered by the court, it is so horrible that they would sooner risk this contempt, the summary judgment, getting thrown in jail or other sanctions, rather than turn this over. So, you know, we'll see what happens. I don't know at this point, having doubled down at least a couple of times, does he finally come around and turn it over?
Does he have enough money? Is the question, because what's our next story?
Well, funny you mentioned that. So from the Washington Post, Rudy Giuliani's former attorney has filed a lawsuit against the former New York mayor, alleging that he owes more than $1.3 million in unpaid legal fees. In a legal document filed this last Monday, Robert Costello and his firm, Davidoff, Hutcher & Citrin LLP, said Giuliani had so far paid only $214,000 of what he owed for more than 3 years of worth of legal representation, leaving $1.36 million outstanding. Now, keep in mind, Costello is the same attorney who sued Bannon and won. A judge ordered Bannon to pay Costello nearly $500,000. So, my read, this is simply they're seeing the writing on the wall. You know, frequently law firms will accept that they're going to take a loss, but they are looking at what's going on with Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss saying, hey, if there's a limited pot of Giuliani money, we need to get our suit in because pretty soon the guy's going to be destitute. And frankly, by the way, if anybody out of this entire episode ends up spending the remainder of their life destitute in jail, I would not be overly disappointed if that ended up being Rudy Giuliani, given his just appalling behavior.
Yeah. Yeah. And, first of all, what's Costello thinking? why does he keep representing these people?
Well, I assume there's money there, right? I mean, he did get that money from Bannon. Bannon is nothing if not a prolific. He's bilking, until he got pardoned by Trump, he was, fleecing, people for various projects that do not appear to have been what he claimed they were. But there's certainly money there. And, wherever Bannon is getting his money, the fact of the matter is that he was able to pay almost, $500,000. And Rudy, I don't know that Trump offering to host dinners for him is going to hit that $1.3 million in unpaid legal fees plus the couple hundred thousand of or 140 so thousand of existing sanctions and then whatever's coming out of the defamation judgment. But,
don't forget his ex-employer is suing him for $10 million as well.
Right, right. And this is all on top of Rudy just being a fucking utter, sorry, I'm swearing in the main show, just a horrible, racist, sexist, asshole in going after and not only attacking Cassidy Hutchinson and things that she had said about, Rudy essentially filling her up on January, well, not essentially, let's call it what it is, sexually assaulting her on January 6th. But then he goes after any number of other people from Olivia Troy to
Dunphy.
To Dunphy, to just a bunch of, folks, largely women who he proceeds to slander and say horrible things about. So it just none of this could happen to a more deserving person. And he just keeps, the first rule, if you're in a hole, stop digging. Not Rudy, by God. He is churning away, digging to the center of the earth.
Yeah, Agreed. And we want to thank the Voices of the People Choir for articulating just how fucked he is. We'll be right back with some sad trombones for House Republicans, along with the status of the New York Attorney General fraud case, which was set to begin October 2nd. Stay with us.
This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me in a courtroom how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. Now it's time to thank our Hall of Fame patrons. You are amazing. Thank you so much to BackdropBooks.com. Another Minneapolitan, excuse me, Sloan Russell, Kirkland J. Bateman, I'm fast at sex, and my new partner agreed to train me so I can get even faster, 3 exclamation points. I am no longer in a shout-out mood. I'm sorry. And I'm a trash bag from Arizona. Thank you so much for being Hall of Fame patrons. I appreciate you all very much. You make this show run. One quick story I wanted to kind of sandwich in here, Pete, before we get to the New York Attorney General, is that we now have multiple IRS and FBI testimony or, you know, testimonials in front of the House behind closed doors in the Hunter Biden probe that are disputing Shapley's contention that David Weiss, who investigated Hunter Biden for 5 years, did not have full authority to bring charges. And this is a new testimony from CNN. A number of FBI and Internal Revenue Service officials, a number, multiple, have now cast doubt on key claims from Shapley. According to transcripts provided to CNN, several FBI and IRS officials brought in for closed-door testimony by House Republicans said they don't remember that U.S. Attorney David Weiss had ever said that he lacked the authority to decide whether to bring charges against the president's son, or that Weiss said he had been denied request for special counsel status. Those claims made by Gary Shapley form the whole foundation of Republican accusations that the Justice Department's investigation into Biden was tainted by political influence. So just to name a couple here, we have, of course, Sobachinsky, I feel like you pronounce it Sobachinsky. Somebody sent me a correction. We also have someone named Hawley, and then somebody else from the IRS. They're all named in this CNN article. And I really just encourage everybody to read this, because Hawley said, I remember overall charges for being a conversation in the sense that it's something that they're all still deciding. I don't remember if it was stated at this meeting that it was not, that those tax years were not going to be charged. I just know that, again, those tax years and others were part of overall discussions. And we also have a couple more people, you know, saying that they were under the complete understanding. Somebody named Walden, he says, I didn't understand that the case was declined, just that they weren't going to partner on the case. But that case would still be able to move forward, which is part of the process, which is a note that Shapley specifically took during that October 7th, 2022 meeting. So now there are multiple people, not just Sobachinsky, who are basically disputing Shapley's testimony. Shapley, who was removed from the case, by the way, by the IRS. So everything's falling apart.
Yeah. And look, it doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, anytime you have a meeting with that many people, do different people hear different nuances of things? Sure. Do some people mishear things and over the period of time think something was said that wasn't? Of course. You know, the fact of the matter is, I think it is not at all surprising that after doubling down on their statements that both Weiss as well as Merrick Garland would be providing one, a consistent statement between the or a version of events between the two of them. And now you've got any number of people who are saying, yeah, that is in fact what happened. And what I'm really interested to see, I think there's, you know, now with potentially Hunter Biden cases headed to trial instead of a plea agreement, I think there's a very, very real chance that discovery is going to turn up some potentially very interesting things, because there are a lot of the swirling rumor, and we've talked about it on the pod before, the swirling rumors about concerns about where information was being leaked from, who might be leaking it, the concern that some of the Shapley and others might have material that they failed to turn over to prosecutors, and only after several months of being asked about it, they eventually did. I am curious to see, at the end of the discovery process for Hunter Biden, what information might exist out there which may further sort of color or provide more information about the credibility of all the different witnesses who are now out there talking about what did or didn't happen. But look, bottom line, it's crap. The entire allegations of the weaponization committee, just like we found there's a, we'll talk about it on the bonus, some conversation with Petro Poroshenko talking to Fox News, essentially saying that all these allegations coming from Shokin, that essentially Shokin, there's something wrong with him, he's a crazy person, utterly undermining some of the, the deepest of the, Hunter Biden Burisma, President, Vice President Biden conspiracies, completely undermining one of the key people in that, one of the key interlocutors with Rudy Giuliani. So it's all crap. It's all crap.
Yeah.
There just is nothing there.
And, we still haven't seen any tax charges from David Weiss. And he's got to be weighing, he went to paper. He wrote letters on multiple occasions saying, I had full authority. I just had to follow a process. I had to go see if I could partner with the local U.S. attorneys. And then if they didn't, I had to ask for a 515 or for special counsel status. I followed the process. It's ridiculous. But there are no tax charges. And I know David Weiss has to be weighing discovery in any tax case and how the case would just get blown apart because of the chain of custody of all the evidence and the public hearings and public testimony from these whistleblowers. That's where the prosecutorial discretion comes in, right? Like, do I really want to bring these charges for $100,000 in unpaid taxes to go through discovery on this? No, I think it would give the DOJ a black eye. It would certainly give the whole investigation into Biden, Hunter Biden, a black eye. And, you know, we might not see, for that reason, any tax charges brought. I guarantee you that the Republicans on the House committee do not want a tax charge trial, because it will expose, like you said, all of this complete and total bullshit.
Yeah. And right. Look, I've said all along, if Hunter Biden is guilty or they can prove and demonstrate evidence of violations of law that are consistent with having brought cases in the past on similar cases, then do it. But okay, if you're going to bring, you know, tax charges, let's talk about, you know, Roger Stone. He and his wife agreed to a $2 million settlement in a tax case back in, you know, mid last year. How different is that than this? $2 million. And Stone
settles.
It's
like 10 times as much money.
You know, let's talk about all these other, you know, like Paul Manafort. Let's talk about all these folks who have had allegations of unpaid federal taxes.
The Trump Organization.
Where has DOJ brought charges and where haven't they? And let's line that up with the amount and fact pattern surrounding Hunter Biden when it comes to tax charges. That's all. And if DOJ has prosecuted cases like that in the past at the level of what Hunter Biden did, then, you know, if they can prove it, they should bring charges.
By all means.
But if not, if you got, you know, the great unindicted Roger Stone for $2 million agreeing to a, you know, out of court settlement, then, you know, maybe let's be consistent about this.
Consistency. And
of course, you know, nobody in the Republican House is, and that's just, you know, the crap we got to put up with and sort through.
Yeah, totally true. And then maybe investigate why there weren't federal charges filed against Roger Stone during that time. And is that weaponization?
It's a mystery. It's a mystery, Allison. What
I
could
don't
it
understand.
Be?
Yeah. All right. So what's going on over in New York?
Yeah.
Some
in New York, an appellate court temporarily paused Trump's New York civil fraud trial, which is set to begin soon, like, you know, October 2nd, so next week. And the attorney general's office told the judges that failing to reverse course could come with serious consequences. Now, Judith Vail, who is the deputy solicitor general for New York Attorney General Letitia James, wrote in a 32-page filing on Wednesday, quote, "Even a brief stay of the October 2 trial date would likely wreak havoc on the trial schedule, not only in this proceeding, but also in scheduled trials in other courts that involve petitioner Donald J. Trump. The court should not countenance such delays, particularly when there is no irreparable harm to petitioners from simply doing work to prepare for and start a trial that has been scheduled for many months," unquote. Now, the current trial may still happen if the appellate judges decide to uphold the rulings of Manhattan Supreme Court Justice Arthur Engoron. And, you know, Engoron, at least in the hearing last week, was animated at some point going after some of Trump's attorneys about, you know, their assertion about, well, you know, everybody lies a little when it comes to valuations, and, you know, calling them a little bit to the carpet, saying, no, that's, you know, a little bit
he pounded the
desk of the bench. Right. So, you know, if that's any indication of kind of where his mind is at, we'll see. But again, there is so much. We talked, I think, last episode about how Trump is reaching a critical mass. You can kick so many cans down the road for so long, but at some point they all sort of come crashing together all at once. And we're starting to see that, right?
This trial would end right before the holidays, right before Christmas time, or, you know, around the holiday season there, I guess, mid-December. And if it gets delayed at all, that pushes it into next year. And in January, we have E. Jean Carroll. In February, we have the pyramid scheme. In March, we have most likely Judge Chutkan in the D.C. trial. And I think that Manhattan D.A. Alvin Bragg, who was set to go in March, conferred with Judge Chutkan and has agreed to sort of step back from that. And then in May, you've got the documents. Like, it's you're now
much crime.
you're now pushing this trial. It's like, hey, man, if you had only done this one crime, yeah, we could probably delay this a little bit. But we can't. And I think that that's the point that the Solicitor General in New York there is making. All right. Next up from Jacqueline Alemany at The Post. Late last month, Republican lawmakers requested that the National Archives turn over a series of documents dating to Joe Biden's tenure as vice president. This is part of their ongoing investigation, the House GOP, to try to find evidence that Biden used his office to help his son Hunter's business affairs. Now, in that request, House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer alleged that the documents would show extensive coordination between Joe and Hunter Biden in Ukraine, where Hunter Biden served, as we know, on the board of Burisma. And there would be damaging evidence that the then vice president used his official perch to enrich his family. Now, Comer told Newsmax, quote, "You're going to see a lot of Democrats hit the panic button when we get those emails." from the National Archives. But cue the sad trombone. Womp, womp. On Thursday, staff members of the House Oversight Committee were briefed. Staff members, by the way. No actual congressmen were there. The staff members were briefed on the first set of documents the archives has prepared to respond to the request. Four emails that revealed Biden family scheduling, a humorous exchange about Biden's status as a new Georgian sex symbol, and praise from the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine for Joe Biden's other son, Beau, who, as we know, has since died. And that's according to people with knowledge of the document's contents. None of the emails were related to Hunter Biden's work on the board of Burisma. Thursday's episode provided the latest example of documents and testimony that House Republicans have chased down only to discover they did not substantiate any allegations that Biden benefited from Hunter's business dealings or used his office to assist them. Of course, the Republicans are accusing the archives now of withholding the important documents.
Yeah, of course. Right.
Oh,
right.
And like I said, they weren't even at the hearing. How many of these behind closed door testimonies have Comer and Jordan just not shown up for? Because they know what they're doing. It's all performative BS.
Yeah. And at some point, I mean, two points to this. One, all of us are paying for this, right? These are congressmen and their staff who are paid for by U.S. taxpayers. So all of this nonsense, all of this performance art, all of these empty gestures that everybody knows, including Comer and Jordan and their staff, everybody knows before they even start them that they are performance art, that nothing is going to come of them. They nevertheless go ahead and do it. And I've got a question, like for those people, and there's some indication that they're, you know, former FBI agents who are working for Jordan and or the weaponization committee. How do you go into work every day and take a paycheck for this sort of nonsense? At some point, do you ever become concerned about the things that you're doing and the nonsense that you're following? At some point, do you worry at all, not only about Jim Jordan and James Comer's credibility, but about your own? But no, nevertheless, we charge down and now, NARA's holding it. They're part of, you know, they're in on it. They must be because of the whole Mar-a-Lago process. They've been co-opted by the deep state. So it must be a NARA problem. No, it's not. It's not. There's nothing there. Absolutely zero.
And that these House Republicans, specifically folks like Jim Jordan, are continuing to take a paycheck to chase down these ghosts while getting ready to shut down the government and stop paying our active duty service members, for example, is just egregious. It's absolutely egregious.
Yeah.
The hypocrisy is stunning. But, you know, again, we are shocked but not surprised.
So I do have, if we go back to the New York AG, some breaking news in the form of Donald J. Trump bleats over in Truth Social. And if you, I can read them for just a couple hours ago. He starts out, "I have been unfairly sued." I'm not going to try and do a horrible Trump accent, but the Trump-hating Democrat Attorney General of New York State, Letitia James, over the false fact that I inflated my financial statements in order to borrow money from banks, etc. The judge in the case, Arthur F. Engeron, refused to allow this case to go to the, quote, commercial division, unquote, where it belongs, because he is a Trump hater even beyond A.G. James, who campaigned against me spewing horrible inflammatory statements which are capital false and capital defamatory. I'm not even allowed a jury. The facts of this case are simple. And then Grandpa hits the caps lock. One, I am worth much more than the numbers shown on my financial statements. Two, I didn't even include my most valuable asset, my brand. Three, the banks were paid back in full, sometimes early.
Yes, he did. And
there
that's
were
illegal.
No defaults. Yeah. Shocking that Donald Trump maybe not telling the entire truth here. There were no defaults. The banks made money, were represented by the best law firms, and were very, quote unquote, happy. There were no victims. Four, on the front page of the financial statements, there is a strong, quote unquote, disclaimer clause telling all not to rely on these. This is second bleat, page two, financial statements, still all caps. The disclaimer clause tells anyone reviewing the data, including financial institutions, to do their own research and analysis. It is a non-reliance clause and could not be more clear. I don't know what a non-reliance clause is, but my attorneys gave it to me to put it in this bleat. He obviously doesn't say that. Additionally, to my being worth far more than is shown in the, quote, fully disclaimed, unquote, financial statements, again, not putting down a value for my biggest asset, brand, the company has hundreds of millions of dollars in cash and very little debt. Turn off the caps lock. It is a great company that has been slandered and maligned by this politically motivated witch hunt. It is very unfair, and I call for help from the highest courts in New York State or the federal system to intercede. Again, back on caps lock. This is not America. So that there's Trump's non-attorney, non-legal filing.
It's got about 500 shell companies associated with the Trump organization.
Yes,
none of
that
is indicted or, you know, being sued over. But he did actually try to include his brand in the valuations, and that was actually called out as
the
part
brand,
of the lawsuit.
The brand, Allison, the brand, those fine Trump steaks, that fine Trump wine, that fine Trump university education, that brand is so...
The presidential shit Trump swag bags they were going to send to Georgia electors to sign their life away.
My Trump NFTs, my Trump challenge coins, my Trump merch, the brand.
The one that's been coming down off of buildings since he was elected because nobody wants it there. That
somehow allegedly continues to be such a fine vehicle for money laundering, some people say. But, you know, it's the brand.
Yeah, I was thinking that the gold M's and the gold P's from the Trump name that were removed from buildings, maybe the Improv could buy those and stick them back up on their brick walls in their comedy clubs because, you know, I mean, giant gold M's and P's have to be kind of hard to come by. I don't think it's in the right font, though. Anyway, just a thought. You know, hawking his gold letters to the Improv to make legal money, that's funny to me. And I have it in my head. It's got it on eBay right now.
Melania and her H-1B genius visa will have some ideas, perhaps, of what to do with those. And just leave it to her. Leave it to her. She'll come up with that.
She can use the T in Be Best. Okay. That is our show. Thank you so much. And a huge thanks to Anna Bauer and the incredible work that she's doing on the ground in Fulton County and elsewhere. You know, she's also covering both of the federal, pretty much anything that is Trump justice related. She's covering for Lawfare. And it was great to have her on for the first couple of segments. So big shout out to her and Lawfare. Please follow her on social media. Any final thoughts before we get out of here for the week, my friend?
No, thanks to Anna. She's doing amazing work. Look forward to future reporting again across the board. You know, she's a rock star down in Fulton County, but she's also been doing, you know, the work up here in D.C. So give her a follow and a listen. And thanks for coming on the show. Thank all of you, particularly patrons, for your support. You make all of these things possible, all these interviews, everything else. So my deep thanks to you as well.
Yeah, patrons, we'll see you this weekend on the bonus episode, and everybody else, we'll talk to you next week. Thank you so much. I've been Allison Gill.
And I'm Pete Strzok.
And this has been Clean Up on Aisle 45. Clean Up on Aisle 45 is written, researched, and produced by Allison Gill, with editing by Molly Hockey. Our art and logo designer by Joelle Reeder and Moxie Design Studios, and our music is composed and performed by Adam Orr. Clean Up on Aisle 45 is a proud member of the MSW Media Network, a collection of creator-owned podcasts dedicated to news, politics, and justice. For more information, visit mswmedia.com. MSW Media.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client
the judge said, show me in a courtroom how we were at war.
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, if I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized.
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.